On today's episode of Locked Up with History, we're going to be looking at the story of Angus Murray, the last man executed at Melbourne jail for a murder he did not commit. How did this man end up at the end of the noose, and how is it connected to the Geelong jail? Stay tuned.
Warning. This podcast contains discussions of some potentially distressing topics. Listeners, please be advised. Come with us for true and tall tales unsurpassed, with stories from Victoria's dark colonial past. Spirits, executions, ghosts, murders and ghouls. These are the stories they don't teach you at school. All these twisted tales of mystique and mystery coming to you now on Locked Up With History.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Locked Up With History, Season 2, Episode 1. My name is Deb Robinson, and on today's episode, we'll be looking at the life and times and the death of Angus Murray in 1924. But firstly, welcome back to Season 2 of Locked Up With History. We have had a little bit longer hiatus than we were intending, but hopefully we're back on track now with some more regular episodes for the remainder of 2022. And if you have any stories that you would like us to address during this season, please feel free to reach out to us at our website. It's lockedupwithhistory.com.au. But now back to the story at hand, the story of Angus Murray.
You're listening to Locked Up With History.
Now, Angus Murray was born in 1881 in Stepney, South Australia, as Henry James Donnelly, the second of 10 children of Henry and Sarah Donnelly. Now, Henry would first appear in the courts in 1892 as an 11-year-old for having an unregistered dog, for which he was fined 20 shillings. It would set the tone for the rest of his life. Now, the next time Henry appeared in court was in 1897 before the Children's Court as a 15-year-old. He'd been charged with stealing 348 oranges from the walled garden on Charles Cornish in Walkerville. He had also given a false name and address, escaped custody, and had been recaptured. He was sentenced to 14 days hard labour at the Adelaide jail to take effect on the date of his next conviction, which wasn't terribly long away. Henry married Ruby Oliver in April 1901 in Adelaide, but despite setting up a boot repair business to go straight, it was only a few months before Henry was once again in trouble before the courts, this time with his brother Charles. Henry and his brother Charles were both brought before the Supreme Court in Adelaide in October 1901 for charges including breaking and entering, stealing from a shop and larceny. The two boys were 17 and 19 respectively, and their mother pleaded for clemency. But the judge was having none of it and stated that both boys were evidently determined to be bad and sentenced them to 18 months hard labour. In August 1903, Donnelly was once again convicted, this time for 7 years, for several housebreakings, including that of the home of the Chief Justice of South Australia. His brother Charles was sentenced to 10 years hard labour. Now, in March 1904 at Yatala Jail, Donnelly was one of the 9 men who escaped from the quarries where they were working. Charles Donnelly was also one of the escapees. At a prearranged signal, they all rushed at the walls and 5 of them managed to get away, but they were all quickly recaptured. The men were sentenced to 3 months imprisonment with 1 day each month in the dark cells on bread and water. In 1909, when he was released, Donnelly headed to Western Australia, now using the name of James Reed, with another criminal called William Griffin. Now, Donnelly was now an accomplished thief and was well known for his careful planning of crimes. Together, the men robbed a store in Murray Street, Perth, of a quantity of jewellery on February 23. Unbeknownst to both men, they had been under police surveillance for several weeks, and the pair were seen digging in a location near the Swan River. And when they returned to their lodgings, they were arrested. Police at the dig site recovered a small quantity of smelted gold and jewellery from the Rosenwax robbery. The pair were both sentenced to 7 years. By the beginning of 1914, Murray was in Victoria and he was now using the name of Angus James Murray.
For a fascinating look at life in a colonial prison, visit Geelong Jail Museum. Situated just over an hour from Melbourne in the heart of Geelong, it's Victoria's most intact and longest continually operating colonial prison. For information, search for Geelong Jail or call 1300 865 800.
On November 14, 1914, Murray married Daisy Mabel Gates at Ballarat, one of the witnesses being a fellow criminal called Robert Bennett. The announcement of their engagement in the paper states that Murray was the second son of Ronald Murray of Merton Grange, Airlie in Scotland. Just a little bit different from being from Stepney in Adelaide. The other problem was Murray was still very much married to his first wife, Ruby. Now, Ruby, unsurprisingly, instigated divorce proceedings in February 1915, citing adultery, misconduct and bigamy as the reasons for divorce. Ruby stated that her husband had never supported her, spending much of his time in prison in South Australia and Western Australia. Ruby further testified that when Murray was served with divorce papers in his birth name, that he had then visited her, put a revolver on the kitchen table, making threats that if she brought the name of Murray into the proceedings, he would do for her. The divorce was granted on the 9th of March 1915. Now, in February 1915, Angus Murray and Robert Bennett were arrested for conspiracy to defraud Frank Dalton. The men had met the former ship steward on a voyage from Sydney to Melbourne, where they floated the idea of a vaudeville and picture show in Manly in New South Wales. Dalton handed over the money, and the trio had looked at land in Manly and talked about how it was all going to work, until the two men disappeared to Melbourne, emptying the bank account as they went. The men were found guilty and sentenced to 2 years in Parramatta Jail for Murray and 12 months in the Bathurst Jail for Bennett. However, the convictions were set aside when an appeal was made over the comments by the Crown Prosecutor of Murray not testifying in his own defence. In September 1915, the pair were once again before the courts, this time for conspiracy to defraud Mary Barrett, on the January 7th of a piano. Murray was sentenced to 6 months imprisonment and Bennett 3 months jail, both in Bathurst Jail. In December 1915, Murray and Bennett were once again brought before the courts on charges brought by Frank Dalton. The men conducting their own defence, but this time they were sentenced to 2 years and 9 months jail, with the judge remarking that Murray was unscrupulous and shameless. Murray was released from the Albury Jail in August 1917 and headed back to Melbourne. On September 18, 1917, Murray took part in an armed robbery of the ES&A Bank in Middle Park in the company once again of Robert Bennett. The two entered the bank armed with a rifle, ordering the teller, Harold Brooke, at gunpoint to climb over the counter where he had been tallying up the day's takings. The gun pointed at him had a silencer, and he feared no one would hear, and so he complied with the request. Brooke was ordered to lay face down on the floor, and with a rifle in his back, had his hands and feet tied. After being asked how much money there was, he was gagged. The men immediately began bagging up the money, and when a clerk from the savings bank knocked on the door, Murray and Bennett quickly made their way out of the back door to a waiting Jinka, thought to be driven by Squizzy Taylor. The two robbers headed to Albury, where they had purchased some collars and a collar box. The box was used to place the money in and was sent to Sydney. Police intercepted Murray and Bennett and sent word to the Melbourne police of their arrest. Murray and Bennett were sentenced to 15 years imprisonment. Now, Murray was initially incarcerated at Pentridge, but would be transferred to Geelong Jail on September 22, 1922. He was generally a well-behaved prisoner and then thought to be trusted enough to be placed in the position of the clerk in charge of prisoner's store, where their clothing was kept while they were imprisoned. Murray also headed up the choir at the jail and was said to have had a most beautiful singing voice. But on the night of August 24, 1923, Angus Murray made his escape. It was a well-planned escape, worked on for several days, if not weeks. Murray hid the implements used in the escape in a cavity he'd carved into the brick wall in his cell. These included a fine saw, a keyhole saw, a file and a poker. He then covered the cavity with bread and dampened paper, and then using paint, it was made to look like the surrounding mortar and would not be discovered by the authorities until after the escape. On the night of the escape, Murray was locked in his cell around 5 p.m. He had been searched and the cell was given a cursory once-over by warder James Kelly. He removed the stones at the base of his window. This was achieved with the help of a prisoner in a neighbouring cell. A rope was passed between cells 51 and 52 using a forked stick. Through a rope pulley system, the bluestone bricks were then dislodged and quietly lowered to the floor of the cell. Once the opening was big enough to loosen the bars, leaving Murray enough room to squeeze through. Murray had torn his bedclothes into shreds to form a rope to lower himself to the ground. He was then able to scale the outside wall using the blanket rope, which was then discovered later over the Swanson Street wall, where a motor car was waiting for him. The escape was discovered by the warder of the tier at 7:45 p.m. He found the cell empty and a 2-foot-6-inch-long-by-9-inch block of bluestone on the floor of the cell. Warders raced outside the walls into Meyer Street and Swanson Street, but did not sight the prisoner, who was still possibly hiding in the jail yards as the rope blanket was not discovered until some time later. A boy passing the jail at the time of the escape saw Murray spring into a waiting car. The police scoured the district but could find no trace of any of the few. 3, 2, 1. A boy passing the jail at the time of the escape saw Murray spring into a waiting car. The police scoured the district but could find no trace of the fugitive. However, Mr. Thorne of MacKillop Street reported that he had a suit, overcoat and hat stolen from his house just behind the jail. Murray's prison uniform was found abandoned in a paddock nearby. Perhaps amusingly, Mr. McPherson, the Inspector General of Prisons, and Major Condo, the Governor of Pentridge, had inspected the Geelong Jail just the day before the escape and had complimented the officials of its stability. Murray's description was immediately forwarded to all police stations in Geelong and all over Victoria by the next day. Police searched all night for the escapee without any sightings. Railway stations were also put on alert as it was feared that Murray would try to escape over the border, having previously been in South Australia and New South Wales. There are a few stories of how Murray got away from the jail to Melbourne, some from Murray himself. One of the more interesting ones is that he stayed in Geelong for the next couple of days, arriving at a local hotel and asking if his luggage had arrived and booked a room. The man booked a car to go to Melbourne and asked the licensee and her friend to accompany him. When the driver arrived, he didn't question it as the licensee was present and they headed to Melbourne. Murray soon disappeared, but a couple of days later, a parcel containing a box of chocolates and the money owed arrived, thanking her for her kindness. The second story is that the car in which Murray was supposed to have entered was driven by Squizzy Taylor outside the walls of the Geelong Jail. And yet a third story stated that Murray was having dinner at the ABC Cafe, or it might have been the Victoria Hotel, at the corner of Moorabool and Little Mallop Street. He reportedly sat at a table right next to the Inspector General, Mr. McPherson, and Major Conda, they having no idea that the escapee that everyone was searching furiously for was leisurely enjoying a meal right beside them. That story came from Angus Murray himself. But whether any of these stories are true or not, we know that Murray managed to make it to Melbourne by the 8th of October 1923, the day of the Glen Ferry robbery.
If you'd like to visit some of the places featured on Locked Up with History, book in a tour with Twisted History. For the full range of tours and to book, visit twistedhistory.net.au.
Now, Thomas Berryman was the bank manager of the Hawthorne Commercial Bank, and he had a routine. Each Monday, he caught the 11:13 a.m. train from Glenferrie to Melbourne head office in Collins Street. He carried with him a leather briefcase containing the banknotes that were to be taken out of circulation. On the 8th of October 1923, his case contained £1,851. As he walked to the station chatting to an acquaintance, Berryman failed to notice the two men loitering near the florist shop. As Berryman parted ways with his friend, the two men came up behind him. Murray placed his hand on Berryman's shoulder and told him, "I can carry that bag." But Berryman refused to surrender the case, replying, "Never mind, I can do it myself." Murray and Berryman struggled for the possession of the case until a shot rang out, fired by Richard Buckley, Murray's companion. Berryman staggered with a bullet wound to his right chest, and Buckley grabbed the suitcase and with Murray ran off, pursued by a couple of bystanders. Witnesses approached the injured man who had replied, "I'm all right, get my case." As a couple of men chased the retreating robbers, Buckley fired a shot to warn them off, and eventually the pair reached a car driven by a third unknown man and made their escape. One man was described as medium height wearing a grey suit and the other as a shorter man wearing a blue suit with a black hat. Interestingly, it was a grey suit that was stolen from the Mr. Thorne just behind the Geelong jail. Now, Berryman was lucky that a wad of papers in his pocket deflected the bullet somewhat. Berryman was taken to the bank where he lived before he was taken to the hospital in critical condition. Berryman was initially in a satisfactory condition, but unfortunately his condition gradually worsened. The police investigation was swift, with one of the witnesses recognising one of the men as Angus Murray. On the morning of the 11th of October 1923 at 5:45 a.m, 12 police surrounded a house at 443 Barclay Street, St Kilda, belonging to Squizzy Taylor. The police surprised the sleeping Murray in his pyjamas. Squizzy Taylor and Ida Pender were also asleep in another room and were also arrested. Murray was charged with escaping legal custody, while Squizzy was charged with being an idle and disorderly person and being the occupier of a house known to be frequented by a reputed thief and others with no visible means of support. Ida was charged with the same charges as Squizzy. Bail was set at £1,000 for Squizzy and £100 for Ida. Murray remained in custody. Murray was charged with robbing Thomas Berryman and having maliciously wounded Berryman. Murray had been positively identified by witnesses as being the principal in the robbery, so he was remanded for a week. Now, Richard Buckley was identified as the second man and the man who had fired the shot at Thomas Berryman. Police had hoped he too would be caught in the raid at St Kilda, but Buckley had gone to ground and was nowhere to be found. It would be many years before he was found. Berryman's condition had started to deteriorate, and the doctors were concerned as the wound became septic. Due to his declining health, it was decided to take his dying depositions to be used in court against Murray. Now, part of this was the removal of Angus Murray from the Melbourne jail to Berryman's hospital bed under police guard for the purposes of identification. A special court was convened at Berryman's bedside so that he could relate the details of the robbery and the shooting. Murray was once again remanded until October 26 on the current charges. Thomas Berryman died on the 21st of October, aged just 51 years, and Murray's charge was upgraded to murder, and he was once again remanded. Now, Murray wasn't happy about the further remand and accused the detectives of trying to frame him instead of searching for the gunman, Richard Buckley. Squizzy had two additional charges added, that of aiding and abetting Angus Murray and Richard Buckley in the commission of a felony. Murray was once again remanded on October 26, causing an outburst by Murray, accusing the police of misleading propaganda and feeding the press misinformation, as they had done in the Colin Ross and the Ned Kelly cases. It didn't go down well with the judge, and he was again remanded for another week. The trial finally got underway on the 20th of February 1924, 4 months after the murder. The court was crowded with many witnesses unable to gain admittance to the courtroom, including Squizzy Taylor. Angus Murray pleaded not guilty to the murder of Thomas Berryman. Evidence was similar to that was presented at the coroner's inquest in November the previous year, where the findings were that Berryman had died of injuries received from wound due to a shot fired by Richard Buckley in conjunction with Angus Murray. The Crown Prosecutor set out to prove that as both men had planned the robbery and the use of weapons, that they were equally guilty of Berryman's murder. Many of the witnesses agreed that Buckley had fired the fatal shot, including the victim Thomas Berryman in his dying deposition. Despite this, Angus Murray was found guilty by the jury after a 2.5 hour deliberation. Justice Mann passed the sentence of death on Angus Murray. Now, despite the appeals that went to the High Court challenging the identification process and a miscarriage of justice, the appeal was upheld and Murray was to be executed. The case was presented to the State Cabinet on March 31st for a full and careful consideration of the death sentence passed on Angus Murray for his complicity in the murder of Thomas Berryman. The Cabinet deliberated on this and pleas for clemency for 90 minutes presided over by the then Premier of Victoria. The decision was upheld that the law should take its course. The decision was confirmed by the Executive Council presided by Lord Stradbroke. The execution would go ahead. It had been more than 60 years since the last execution of a man for being an accomplice. There were many protests and attempts to have the execution overturned. The Melbourne branch of the ALP carried a motion of protest against the death penalty being carried out. Several parties waited on the Attorney General seeking the commutation of the death sentence, which were all denied. Public outcry against the death sentence was obvious, with a petition of over 70,000 signatures, public meetings and a protest attended by thousands organised by the Trades Hall Council. Protesters held up banners reading, "Workers prevent the crucifixion of Angus Murray and remember the gallows government." But all was to no avail, and the execution went ahead as planned. In the early hours of April 14, 1924, people began to gather near the gates of the Melbourne jail. Most of the crowd were made up of women, as the men could not afford to take a day off work. By 9 a.m, some of the crowd were already kneeling in prayer and some women sobbing. By 9:40, the crowd sang, "Nearer, my God, to thee." At 9:45 a.m, the crowd began marching towards the gates, with authorities fearing a riot from the emotional crowd. 40 foot police, 10 mounted police held the crowd back from the gates. People demanded that police remove their helmets, and one woman threw herself at one of the horses. The only other time there was such a gathering previously was at the execution of Ned Kelly in 1880, and it would happen again at the execution of Ronald Ryan in 1967. Just before 10 a.m, the crowd kneeled and recited the Lord's Prayer, followed by complete silence for 5 minutes as the time of execution passed. Inside the Melbourne jail, Angus Murray was walked to the gallows. His last words were, "I have never done anything in my life to justify the extreme penalty being passed on me. I have tried to forgive all of those who have acted against me. I hope all that I have injured will forgive me." He then turned to the hangman and said, "Pull it tight." Angus Murray was the final man executed at the Melbourne jail before its closure in 1924. Richard Buckley, the man who fired the fatal shot in 1923, was not captured until 7 years later in 1930 in a house in Ascot Vale. Buckley was convicted of the murder of Thomas Berryman and was sentenced to death also, but this time it was commuted to life imprisonment by the Executive Council, given the length of time since the murder and the fact that he was an old man. He spent many years in the Geelong jail before he was released at the age of 84 on his family's wish that he did not die behind bars. But Buckley enjoyed 7 more years of life on the outside before dying peacefully in his sleep at 90 years of age.
Interested in learning more about this episode? Join the Locked Up With History Facebook group for more facts and discussions about the dark colonial past of Victoria and beyond.
Now, Angus Murray left a lasting legacy at the Geelong Jail after his escape and his death. In January 1924, penal authorities abolished the freestanding tables that were in each cell due to Murray's use of his cell table to reach the window and escape. Instead, they were replaced with a drop table affixed to the side wall, examples of which can still be seen in the cells of the Geelong Jail today. But before we wrap up the story of Angus Murray, don't forget to check out our webpage at lockedupwithhistory.com.au, where all of the previous episodes are, along with some of the photos for the episodes where we have them. Of course, you can also listen to all of the episodes on your favourite podcast streaming platform. If you have any questions or would like to discuss any of the episodes, join us over on Facebook and the Locked Up With History group. This is where you can ask me any questions on current episodes and where you can view any of the media associated with the episodes as well. And as I said before, if you have any suggestions on a story you might like to hear about, please feel free to send us a message either in the group or to one of our emails, and of course we will certainly consider it. But our next episode, we will be looking at the story of George Melville and the MacIver private escort robbery. How did the body of one of the bushrangers end up on display in the front window of a shop in Little Bourke Street? Until then, see you on the darker side of history.
more information on the story from today's episode, check out the show notes or join the Locked Up With History Facebook group. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.